AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. A rare Saturday session for the Senate produces a $1.1 trillion bill that funds most of the federal government through the end of the fiscal year, September 30th. Jackie Quinn has more.
There was some controversy before the bill was passed in the Senate on a 56-40 vote. Texas Republican Ted Cruz urged lawmakers to use it to challenge President Obama's executive actions on immigration.
Show America whether they stand with a president who is defying the will of the voters or with the millions of Americans who want a safe and legal immigration system.
Majority Leader Harry Reid.
Constitution objection is completely without merit.
Many Democrats objected to the repeal of banking regulations. This compromise funds much of the government through September 30th. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Protesters marched in a number of cities yesterday. In Washington, Esau Garner, wife of Eric Garner, who died as New York City police tried to arrest him, says he didn't die in vain.
My husband was a quiet man, but he's making a lot of noise right now, and his voice will be heard.
After a peaceful march in New York, a group of demonstrators became violent against police as they walked across the Brooklyn Bridge.
Debris was being thrown from the walkway down at the police officers on the roadway.
Chief of Department James O'Neill, when two officers tried to make an arrest, people in the crowd jumped them, beating and kicking them. There were no arrests, but police did find a backpack that had been stuffed with hammers. Auburn University freshman football player Jaquel Mitchell has been shot and killed at an apartment complex near the campus early this morning. Auburn City Police Captain Will Matthews says there have been no arrests as of yet.
We have not taken the suspect into custody at this time, and the investigation is still ongoing.
Mitchell redshirted this season for the Auburn Tiger football team. This is AP Radio News. It's been 2 years since 20 children and 6 educators were killed inside an elementary school by Adam Lanza in Newtown, Connecticut. AP's Julie Walker reports that as the town recovers, there are still many unanswered questions.
While Lanza's obsessions with guns, death, and mass shootings are now well documented, the motive for the massacre may never be fully known. A report released last month by Connecticut's Office of the Child Advocate found that Lanza's parents, education team, and others missed signs of how deeply troubled he was and opportunities for appropriate treatment.
Midnight Monday Pacific time. That's the deadline to sign up for or make changes to health insurance for 2015. Premium increases expected for most customers. Healthcare.gov is expecting heavy traffic. Telephone hold times at the Federal Call Center are already starting to creep up. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Tyson's Corner offices of Optifor. I'm Dana Theus with InPowerCoaching.com, and I'm here with my co-host, Mark Cohen, Optifor. Mark, why don't you tell us about our guest today?
Well, Dana, we have a great lineup. First is Pat Harrison, the president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Next is Nadi Samnong, the president, chairman, and CEO of Omnifix. Third is Judd Allen, a co-founder and managing partner of Express Home Buyers. And we're going to end today with Steve Martin, the president of Pace Harmon.
Thanks. So we get to start with Pat Harrison, president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Pat, what is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
The corporation, or CPB as we refer to it, is the steward of the federal appropriation. 90% of those funds go directly back to the states to public television and radio stations so they can serve their communities.
So tell us, how big is that organization?
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting dispenses money not only to stations but to PBS and to NPR.
How many stations?
So there are, in terms of public television stations, there are approximately 380 PBS stations and close to 1,000 radio stations.
How did you get involved with this amazing organization?
Well, my life has, like many people, has had not a straight line. I started out as a writer. I was an entrepreneur for 20 years. I was Assistant Secretary of State for Educational Cultural Affairs under Secretary Powell. And in 2005, a search firm came and interviewed me. And voila, I am now the CEO and president.
Somehow, you got a drive and an ability to move with big players early on. And I think it came from when you grew up in Brooklyn, based on what you were telling us earlier. Tell us about when you were growing up. What were your mom and dad doing?
You know, it's a paraphrase of everything I learned in life. I learned in Brooklyn. And I come from an Italian-American family, and it was pretty energetic. And the focus was, you can do anything you want, but never forget your family. Family's the most important thing. They're there in times of challenge and in times of success. And if you have that strength, you can do everything. And what I'm concerned about, we have 1 million young people who fail to graduate from high school every year. And guess what? Not so astounding. The research shows these kids are great kids, but they need somebody in their lives to be there for them, the way I had and still do my family.
So there was a little bit of tension, though, in your family between your mother and your father. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, because my father, Italian-American, Catholic, and my mother, Protestant, from the South. So it was really, when I was growing up, a clash of cultures. Plus, I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. So it was pretty much the UN, and I had an opportunity to really see people from different backgrounds and heritage. I went to school with Jackie Robinson's niece, and it was a microcosm of the world to a certain extent. But the Italian side of my family really became, I would say, the triumphant gene, because they were so energetic and they were so opinionated, and they were so full of life to a certain extent. And that family focus really is what was conveyed to me at a very young age.
So what's interesting to me is you're describing this childhood full of, you know, boisterous personalities, which sounds probably a little similar to the situation you find yourself in as the head of a major public corporation. What skills did you learn back there to survive that you find yourself using today?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, when I was growing up, we used to laugh at the expression that in New York, conversation is talking and waiting to talk. And what I had to learn is you have to listen. So I was able to observe at a very young age in my whole family, in my neighborhood, to understand people's behavior to a certain degree and how to get things done. Because when you're the youngest and you're surrounded by adults, it was a time when parents and aunts and uncles included you, but they didn't make anything special for you. So you had to sort of scrabble along to make your own way. And you learned a lot. You fell down, you got up.
You told us a great story of second grade failure. I wonder if you could share that with us. I personally resonate with it.
Well, it's so humiliating to have to repeat this again. But when I was in the second grade, we were transferring from using pencils, writing, and learning penmanship. I don't know if anybody knows what penmanship is anymore. And you could not begin to write with a pen until your penmanship was acceptable. And I was the last person in that class to be able to write with a pen. And I knew what it felt like to come in last, and I thought, never again. And that pretty much was a pivotal point. I like to call it my rosebud moment.
And it sounds like you've really brought it forward with you, this determination.
Yes, and I, you know, as we talk about where we come from and what makes people, basically shapes them, who they are, I think it is this idea in this country that we're an entrepreneurial people, that we look at a problem and we try to solve it. When I served as Assistant Secretary of State under Secretary Powell, the one thing that people from other countries, it didn't matter where they were from, what their race, what their heritage, that they commented on was how Americans volunteer, how if there's a problem, people will get together and they will fix it. And that's the big thing that they took back when they went to their own countries. Our DNA is really a volunteer ethic, and it's connected to that entrepreneurial drive.
That's an interesting connection, and actually I was going to ask you about that. You were an entrepreneur yourself,
yes.
And then you kind of veered into public life. What was that about?
I seem to have veered into a lot of different things. My husband and I had a company for 20 years, which we sold, and then I got involved in politics. I wrote two books about women and leadership, and one thing led to the other. And I think the defining thing for people in terms of success, in addition to looking at life in an entrepreneurial way and not as a victim, is to be curious. To ask questions. Why? Why does this happen? Well, why can't it happen that way? And then to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you, but who have high energy and drive. You can't do anything unless you have high energy, drive, and enthusiasm and love for what you do.
So I've got to ask this because you're a woman in leadership. You've written two books about women in leadership. If you look at the statistics, you're not in the majority. What would you say are the one or two things that women should take away thinking about what they can do to get into leadership if they desire?
Well, there's more opportunity now for women than ever before. And in terms of women's wealth, there's going to be a huge transfer in the next 5 years where women's wealth does not come from marriage. It comes from business ownership and more of an independent source. And women are contributing on higher and higher levels to charities. So a lot of women are stepping up to the leadership plate, and they are doing it in a way that they're defining leadership so they don't fit into a prescribed mold. They are leaning in. Some of them are leaning out. And I think the mistake we made perhaps 25 years ago was telling women, you must do this. There are women who fortunately have the choice to stay home. Most women don't because of economics. But we're less harsh about what it means to be a woman in the workplace, a woman at home, a woman as a citizen, or a woman as a politician.
And you have a family. I do.
But I didn't do it all at once.
Aha. Uh-huh. Tell us about that.
Well, when my children were growing up, I was a freelance writer. I had to lock myself in the bathroom just to keep them out and get some privacy because it was the only room in the house that had a lock. And I thought, this is going to be my life forever. And you just have to look at things in stages. And there are points today where I wish I had those days back when they were little and I could tell them what to do. And now they're grown.
I take it they're not little anymore.
Now they're not. They're grown. They have children. And, You're always preparing for what you're doing at the time you're doing it. So it's not you stop and start. And you should cherish where you are right now, because it will fill that that vessel that is describing who you are later on.
Mom and Dad, who are you more like, Mom or Dad?
It depends what day of the week you ask me. My father, Italian-American, and my mother, of Scottish heritage, and I used to say one half of me wants to have fun and the other half says you can't afford it. They were wonderful, wonderful people, and very strong work ethic, loved this country, because my grandfather came over from Italy when he was 15. And he used to tell the story of the eagle and the turtle. And he always would say, Patricia, the turtle has a shell. Everybody gives him some food, but the eagle flies high. What are you going to be, an eagle or a turtle? And I'm going to be an eagle, Granddad. No, I'm going to be an eagle. All right, here's a quarter. but I thought about that story many, many years later. At the time, I was just sighed. Do I have to go through this again? Because every time we go over, every week, every Sunday.
The same question.
You're going to be a turtle or an eagle? And we're still deciding.
Well, it sounds like his plan worked. You're still thinking about that question.
Yeah, it's a good question.
So what makes you excited to get up and get out of bed in the morning?
One of the things I love about public media is our high-quality content enables people to access lifelong learning from the very, very youngest, and we've measured what we do, ready to learn, getting kids, especially in high poverty neighborhoods, ready for school. Our American Graduate Initiative works with high school dropouts. The talent is there, the smarts are there, they just need mentors. So what gets me up in the morning is seeing the possibilities of how we can strengthen our democracy through public media, which is my job, and to connect the people of goodwill who make things happen, because it's people who make things happen. It's not a cartoon character or something out of a comic book. It's actual people who are not famous, who get up every single day and go to work, people of goodwill, who shape what this country looks like.
One last question I just have to ask. Are you going to be a turtle or an eagle? If Grandpa were sitting right here.
An eagle, definitely an eagle. Flying high.
What's the website?
Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Dana Theis with my co-host, Mark Cohen of Opti4. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a minute right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Dr. Shirley Davis, President and CEO, The Success Doctor. Welcome, Shirley. Shirley, what's The Success Doctor all about?
It's a global workforce and talent management consulting organization. What we do is track trends, and we identify best practices and strategies for organizations around the world of all sizes, all industries, mm-hmm. and help them understand how to get great talent, how to keep it, and how to make sure that they get the most out of it.
And what's your role in the company?
My role is president and CEO, and I actually do a lot of the coaching and speaking and consulting.
And what do you like most about that?
Absolutely love the strategy development and helping to get leaders to that aha moment.
Mm-hmm. And what makes the organization so special, in your view?
Capturing a lot of the great best practices that we've been able to do. And I think, you know, my brand, I build great relationships and I provide them what they need instead of what I want them to have.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the clients appreciate most about you and your company?
I make the strategies, even though they're global, I make them very, very customized and practical.
Uh-huh. And who, in your view, is the ideal client, the perfect client?
The perfect client is one that has a need, and the perfect client is one that can recognize that there is an opportunity with the strategies that we provide for them to make their organizations better.
Mm-hmm. And what do you personally enjoy most about the work?
I love seeing the strategies come to life. I love seeing the impact and the results that come as a result of it. Mm-hmm. And I love when they call me back and thank me because they've seen change.
That's excellent. And what's the website for the company?
DrShirleyDavis.com. That's www.drshirleydavis.com.
Thank you, Shirley. We've been speaking with Dr. Shirley Davis, President and CEO, The Success Doctor. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
And your name is?
Dana Theus.
And the name of the organization?
InPowerCoaching.com.
And what does Empower Coaching do?
Well, we support mid-level to senior managers and leaders achieve professional success by developing themselves personally.
Why does this turn you on so much?
Well, I have found in my own experience and my own leadership journey that the better I was at being a good human being, the better leader and the better business I ran and the more successful I was. And I want to help other people do that.
So you're able to help the folks in an organization throughout the organization achieve what they're looking for, as well as help the organization move forward.
Well, to move an organization forward, you've got to master the soft skills of dealing with people effectively. You've got to learn to negotiate every relationship successfully for both parties. You have to communicate confidently. I support people and help them learn to develop those skills themselves to be strong leaders.
And you have a specialty working with women?
I do work a lot with women. They're drawn to this work, but not exclusively.
And to learn more about what you're up to, is there a website address?
InPowerCoaching.com. That's InPowerCoaching.com.
Excellent. This has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theus, with my co-host, Mark Cohen of Optifor. Next up, we have Nadi Samnang, Chairman and CEO of Omnifix. Nadi, what is Omnifix?
Omnifix is a full-service commercial office furniture vendor. We provide anything that can be put inside an office building, from chairs, conferences, private offices, anything else, you name it, we can provide for it.
And how big or small is it?
We are about $25 million company with 26 employees at the moment, looking to grow.
And we happen to know from our previous conversation, you're 8 months into this business and this industry, and you have taken on quite a challenge in buying this business, right?
That's right.
So what is it about the challenge of going into a new industry that feels familiar to you?
You know, I think I've been challenged my whole life, being that I'm Cambodian, and I immigrated here in 1983, you know, going to school.
How old were you?
I was three when I came here in 83. And starting school, I couldn't even speak English, let alone write my name. And so I think I've had these challenges ever since I was young. And so the challenge of going into a new business and a new industry that I'm not familiar with was quite, you know, a challenge and appealing for me.
Why did your parents come here?
You know, they grew up during the time of the Khmer Rouge.
The killing fields,
a mass genocide there. I think Cambodians lost 3 to 4 million people at the time. So they were escaping to live. It was really if you didn't know whether you were going to live or not, and you had to make a choice. So they made a choice, and luckily we had some sponsors, sponsor some of my extended family, and we were able, well, my parents were able to get out, cross the border, go to Thailand, and go into the camps there, and fortunately, we got lucky enough to immigrate to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
So I'm curious, growing up, you were the only one that spoke English in some situations, and you're in this new place, and you don't have the extended family that you might have if you'd been able to stay at home. What stories did your parents tell you that helped you become successful here?
You know, it was really the struggles of them escaping, being in the slave camps.
They were actually in the camps.
That's right. They were actually slaves under the Khmer Rouge regime.
How did they escape?
You know, it was in the middle of the night one time, and they all got together and just made a run for it. And they literally ran through jungles and rivers and, you know, without any food to eat. And I was probably two years old at the time. And so they just kept running and running, and it's really just you run for your life.
And here you are in business owning a furniture company. What? How the heck does that happen?
So, yeah, again, growing up, I was always, you know, challenged, and it was always hard for anyone in my family to really assimilate into the American culture here, and that's everything from understanding laws and understanding the rules and regulations and things like that. So I was always sort of forced into a leadership role
growing up. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have two younger brothers.
So you were the oldest.
I am the oldest. So I had to assist my parents a lot with just everyday life when it came to bills and just, you know, taxes and whatnot. And so, again, I think that role sort of propelled me into taking on a leadership role. And I think the appeal of owning your own business is you are the leader. You are going to be the one making the final decisions, good or bad.
Is entrepreneurship what you expected?
Yes, it is for the most part. But I think you don't know until you finally do it. A lot of the things that you learn from your mistakes or when you fall. So before I had the furniture dealership that I have now, you know, I had a restaurant that I'll never do again.
That was not a success?
Yeah, I don't know.
So what did you learn from that?
You know, I don't want to say failures, but I think some of the mistakes I made of owning a restaurant were not fully calculating the restrictions I had because it was a franchise. And when you franchise something, you have to really stick to their rules and regulations. You know, you have to buy all your materials from a specific vendor. You can't, you know, deviate from their prices and all their menu items and things like that. And so I think what I learned was you have to be smarter about where you put your money. And it's things like picking the location, overhead, your rent. And I think we rushed into it. And part of the other mistake I'm going to say is I did it with my family. So I wouldn't do that again either. Going into business with your immediate family is really tough. Really tough.
So you had your parents or your brothers?
Everyone.
Everyone was working
in the
restaurant.
You got it. Yep. And so, you know, we, as a family, you barely get along, you know, without a business. So you throw a business into the mix and it's just a bomb waiting to blow up. And so I think that was part of the challenges and the things that I've learned from as well is never do business with your family. So in my situation, that is, I'm sure it works for other situations. But again, the financial lessons were the hardest that we learned.
One thing that's interesting to me about that is that, you know, never do business with your family. And yet we know that your father was a very important mentor to you early on. What did he give you early in life that you called on to pull away from him later in the business?
Yeah, and I think the thing he kept stressing and sort of reminding me in life is you're in America now. You probably wouldn't be alive if you were still in Cambodia. Take advantage of the opportunity that America has given to you and everyone else who will take advantage of what it has to offer. And it's simple things like school. You know, you go to school here for free. Well, not for free, your taxes pay for it, but essentially it's, you know, for free in my mind. So take the education, leverage it, go to high school, finish high school, go to college, get an education. And I think he kept stressing that every year of my life, and I'm glad he did, because that's where you learn to be the man you are now, is through the, you know, those times of being educating yourself, not just at school, but with your peers, with other business people, with other people who have been there before.
Well, and also you had mentioned that, you know, you didn't grow up in a business. Your family didn't have a business when you were young. And so you had to learn business the hard way, but you had the freedom and the ability to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Growing up, my parents were factory workers working minimum wage. You know, they didn't speak English and understand computers or anything like that.
And you went into IT.
I did. Sort of.
What was that about?
I guess technically I'm a millennial, and you know, with the millennials, we created the wave, right? We created the internet and all the technology, and so it was just the thing to do at the time, right? And also at the time, you know, I came out of college in 2004. IT was they paid very well. Technology was a big field and rapidly growing. And so what I did was, you know, I leveraged what I learned selling software programming, and I started my own IT firm. It was a one-man shop, and we did okay, but it was I wanted something bigger and better.
Are you more like your mom or your dad?
You know, I'd say I'm more like my dad, and the reason I say that is because my mom tells me that. he plays guitar, so do I. He plays drums, so do I.
Are you in a band?
No, we just play for fun. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, but he's very stubborn, and I can be too. but he's also a leader, and I think he's, you know, he led the charge to save our lives, and I think that's passed down to me, you know, from the bloodline. So I'm very grateful for it.
Is there ever a point in your current life where you feel like you're saving lives?
You know, I think right now, you know, I've got the lives of 26 people in my hands. One wrong move and I could literally ruin the lives of all my employees that I have. And so now there's even bigger pressure to really do the right thing and take these calculated risks of knowing that it's not just my own well-being that I'm affecting, but I have employees that I'm affecting as well. So in a sense, I think that I'm not just saving lives, but helping their lives, mm-hmm. you know.
So if your dad were here right now, what would you like to tell him you've never told him before?
I would probably want to thank him for pushing me to get my education. And I think that's a big issue in America. And I can say that, especially in the Asian community, where their parents fought and struggled to get here. But then the kids grow up in America. They don't think they realize how important it is that they get that education, that they're already here. So they sort of become complacent, so to speak. And I think just being in America is also a privilege by itself. I mean, being homeless in D.C. is a better life than having a regular life in a third world country. And that's really a true comparison that I can really say. And so I think the push for the education is the greatest thing that I would also pass down to my kids and anyone else who's listening.
What's the website?
www.omnifix.com. And Omnifix is spelled OMNIFICS.
This is Dana Theis with my co-host, Mark Cohen of Opti4. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this business spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. Welcome, Jody. Jody, what is Acumetrics?
Acumetrics is a firm that works with CEOs that are interested in growing their revenues and bottom lines in a scalable, sustainable way.
And what's your role within the company?
I'm the founder and president.
And what is it about the job that you bring that's so unique to you, that special gift, as we say?
That special gift? I enjoy working with the CEOs to have them achieve goals that they thought were impossible.
And what is it about the organization that makes it so special?
Our clients say that it's the three P's: our people, our platform, and our processes. Our people are highly qualified and they're fun to work with. Mm-hmm. Our processes are enabling of reliable and timely financial information, and our platform is scalable.
And who is, or what is perhaps, the perfect client for you?
Businesses of any size that want reliable, timely financial information.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I enjoy working with the clients and making a difference. We like to help the CEOs understand their financial information so they can make different choices tomorrow to impact future results of the business.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.acumetricsllc.com.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Les.
We've been speaking with Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Wes Burnett, partner at Opti4. Wes, what is Opti4?
Opti4 is a securities firm that integrates legal, tax, and financial and risk in order to offer optimal results for clients.
Who's your perfect client?
Perfect client is someone who actually would like to combine services, make their life simpler, and is very family-oriented. Our firm itself is very family-oriented. We love helping families take care of their own, and that can be multi-generational.
So what would a family need when they would come to you?
Typically, what they're doing is trying to simplify their personal life by trying to have somebody else worry about their legal and their tax and financial affairs and present them with solutions rather than questions.
Solutions rather than questions. So give us an example of a good solution.
Well, a good solution is something that results, for example, in the lowest tax bill, the greatest savings, and taking care of the values important to the family, like saving for college for children or grandchildren or something along those lines.
So what do you enjoy most about your work?
My clients. Although a second place, close would be my staff, because I recruit very specifically people who have the same values as our clients. So we truly are very involved with our clients' lives, and they are family to us.
What about your family? Are they in the business too?
No. Although there's certainly plenty of lawyers and financial advisors and so on in the business. But no, they all have their own lives, and we're very pleased, quite frankly, with that. I actually have a wife who's a teacher for 42 years, so I take a lot of my values from her.
What is the website?
Optifor.com, OPTIFOUR.com.
Thanks for listening to this Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-host, Mark Cohen of Optifor. Next up, we have Judd Allen, co-founder and managing partner of Express Home Buyers. Judd, what is Express Home Buyers?
We're a residential real estate company, been around about 12 years. We buy, fix, and sell real estate in the Metro DC area. Done about 1,500 houses since we started, mostly primarily within about a 20-mile radius of downtown DC.
And you have a partner. You're not in this risky business alone.
Yeah, I have a partner, Brad Chandler, who you may have seen on TV.
Right.
I met him about 12 years ago. We were both starting out in the business, and Brad had grown up with a father who had advertised on TV for his business and was planning on utilizing that in the real estate business. And I had done a couple deals and had a little bit of success and happened upon Brad. I actually found Brad. He had posted a sign in my neighborhood, a We Buy Houses sign, and wanted to know who was coming in to my turf. And so I called him, and we had lunch and formed a business over lunch that day.
Yeah. Which is kind of an amazing story. And I'm curious, though, so you guys are similar in a lot of ways. Did your dad grow up doing advertising on TV?
No. My dad's a physician. Mom's a homemaker. I'm one of four kids. And
where are you in the pecking order?
I'm number two. I have an older sister, a little sister, and then a brother who actually works for us. Has worked for us for about 10 years.
Is Brad by any chance the older sibling in his lineup?
He might be the baby. He's either number two or number three.
Oh, interesting. So my theory just got shot.
So where did you grow up?
I'm from Roanoke. I was born in Charlottesville. My dad did his residency in Charlottesville, lived there till I was five, and spent the rest of my time in Roanoke until I went to college. And after college, I really never went back.
What was your first job?
I mowed lawns. I remember having an Apple IIe with a dot matrix printer, and I found a logo. I guess it wasn't a website because they didn't have it back then, but I found a logo off of a floppy disk and cut and pasted a logo of a lawnmower, and then put in some type that said, if you need your yard mowed, call Judd Allen. And I printed those out and distributed them to neighbors, and I think I mowed every neighbor's yard in our neighborhood.
And what did you do with the money?
I bought I guess I wasted a lot, but the thing I can remember saving for was a $120 silver Bolt BMX bike.
So you started in real estate, mowing lawns, and here, right. Here you are in real estate. Were you ever tempted to go into medicine, follow your dad's footsteps?
You know what? I guess I thought I was, but I wasn't a great student, and I had trouble sitting still, and I realized pretty quickly that there was going to be a lot of sitting still and studying. And I preferred to be active and doing things as opposed to studying and reading.
You told a great story about a turning point in your life around 9/11, where you got into this business. Tell us what happened.
So I was a headhunter.
A recruiter.
A recruiter, exactly. I placed accounting and finance professionals. And I was making a really good living. I had fairly young. I'm 42 now, so I was 25 or 26 when I started doing that and making a very good living. And then the dot-com bubble burst, and I went from making a good living to not much of a living. And
that's because you were on commission. You weren't on a salary at that point.
I've never had a salary job. I've worked as, commission only ever since I can remember, or ever since I had my first job. So I had a really great friend who was very generous with his time, and when the world was, when the dot-com bubble was bursting and my career was going nowhere, he offered to have me down to the to where he lived and sort of show me what he was doing. And so I went down for about a week, followed him around, and on the way back, I placed an order to buy 1,000 We Buy Houses signs, which I then started nailing on every telephone pole and on sign or on posts and putting them in the middle of the median all over Northern Virginia. And it actually happened to be right at the time the DC sniper was killing people. So it was scary. It was scary banging signs while that was going on.
Had you ever bought a house before?
I hadn't. Well, I take that back. I owned one of my own, but I'd never bought an investment property and really had no idea what I was doing. I remember putting these signs up and I would get phone calls, and for a period of 3 or 4 months, I sort of fumbled my way through, and eventually I found a person who needed to sell, and I knew just barely enough to consummate the deal. I actually ended up buying the property in a Kinko's, meaning I had her sign the paperwork in a Kinko's, and then I went and recorded the deed myself at Prince William County Courthouse to make myself the owner.
That takes a lot of confidence to go into a business, not just a business where you have to do something you've never done before, but it requires money and cash outlay and risk associated with cash. Where do you come up with that kind of confidence? Were you born with it?
You know, I think my parents, I don't know. I must have been, because I can't point to a seminal event that made me feel like I could do anything. I think I sort of grew up that way my whole life.
You told us about your big wheel.
Right. I mean, I've seen a picture of myself about 4 feet off the ground as a five-year-old on my big wheel, you know, careening down a hill. And my parents tell me that was really sort of par for the course. But I think it's a function of parents telling you you can do anything and giving you enough rope to sort of figure things out for yourself. I'm one of four, and I there wasn't enough days or, you know, hours in the day for mom to police everything with four kids.
So how big is Express Home Buyers right now?
We're about a $30 million revenues company. We're 12 employees. We outsource all of our construction work. There's probably 50 to 100 people swinging hammers, et cetera, for us, that who are sort of more or less our employees, but just through subcontractors. And we're just local right now. We have aspirations to be the CarMax of residential real estate. We'd like to go a bunch of places, but we're sort of figuring things out and making sure we get things right here first.
But no, so your whole career up until now has been essentially in sales, right?
Right.
How did you learn to run a $30 million company?
Lots of mistakes. I mean, lots of trial and error. With buying and fixing 1,500 houses, you figure out, you see a lot of situations and a lot of themes, and you see recurring themes, and you make enough mistakes with it's where it's your own money. It's a great educator not to step in that again or not to do it again. So I'd say a lot of it's just sort of, you know, on-the-job training and learning from mistakes. And I have a natural affinity for numbers. So the finance part comes very easy to me. And the sales part is, you know, that's part of it. And then I think the way I was raised and doing right by people, you know, comes into it too. We've had fantastic investors. We've had one particular investor who's been with us for almost 10 years, and we've barred and returned almost $300 million to them. And we've been great partners because we've always done what we said we would.
So when you look back on your upbringing in with a physician and a housewife as parents, what do you feel like, you know, they gave you that is endemic to your success today?
So I would say work ethic. My dad worked hard. My mom worked hard. My mom is actually was just here for Thanksgiving. and or my both my parents were, and my mom literally did not sit down the entire day, you know, just doing laundry, cleaning, cooking, playing with the kids. And she's 70 years old, so I think it's really cool to see that. And the other thing I got from my mom is sort of frugality. My wife kids me that I, you know, use my finger to scrape the peanut butter jar, or I remember growing up going to fast food places and ordering water because I didn't want to spend a dollar on a soda. And I think I got that from my mom. And then hard work from both my parents.
What does success mean to you?
I mean, it's a journey, and I think success looks like waking up being happy. I have three kids. I'm happiest when I'm doing something with them. Both my son and my daughter, you know, came and laid on me this morning before, you know, from 3 to 6 a.m. And that seems really happy to me. That makes me very happy. I'm very fortunate that I love what I do, so it doesn't feel like work. And I think that's probably, you know, my family and liking what I do gives me a sense of purpose.
What's the website?
ExpressHomeBuyers.com.
This is Dana Theus with my co-host, Mark Cohen. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment after this business spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn & Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here. And they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohn & Burnett?
CohnAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A and D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Dana Theus, with my co-host, Mark Cohn of Optifor. Next up, we have Steve Martin, president of Pace Harmon. Steve, what is Pace Harmon?
Pace Harmon is a management consulting firm. We focus on business operations improvement primarily through the lens of answering the insourcing-outsourcing question, be it IT or finance and accounting or human resources, and then secondarily through business process optimization.
And how big or small is the organization?
70 consultants, three offices, Tysons Corner, Virginia, Chicago, and San Francisco.
And you're co-founder?
Co-founder.
So did you come out of an entrepreneurial background to decide to start this, what is now a big, thriving business?
Could not have been any further from an entrepreneurial background. So I spent the prior 20 years at Deloitte Consulting, large company, obviously, last 13 there was a partner running a number of industry groups, and one of my other partners and myself decided to take a shot at this. We had a good opportunity with a backbone client, and we launched about 11 years ago.
Where did you grow up?
Grew up in Bethesda, Maryland.
Mom and Dad, what were they doing?
Dad was a physicist, worked for the Department of the Navy designing submarines, and my mother was a nurse until my baby brother came along, and she became a stay-at-home mom.
So I'm curious about the pattern of risk in your life, because your whole job is calculating risk for people. Were you a reckless kid or a risk-averse kid?
I was a rambunctious kid. Don't recall about the level of risk aversion or not. My recollection is that if there was a dare by my brother or a friend, I probably would take it without thinking too much about the consequences. But that was, I'm not sure if that was risk aversion or stupidity, but one of the two.
What was your favorite thing to do when you were a kid?
It was all sports. I mean, I'd love to have a better answer, but it was baseball and basketball and football and very good friendships. Incredibly fortunate to have a family of you know, parents that were loving and siblings that were there for us and were still in the area. So one of these very fortunate childhoods.
So I'm curious what you got from sports that you find you call on today. Is it the competitiveness?
I think it's two things. It's competitiveness is one, be it competing for a resource, a new consultant, or competing for a new project. So that's clearly at the top of the list. I think second is just the work ethic. I grew up under a couple of coaches that were very driven, that were themselves trying to move to the next level, be it from junior high to high school or high school to college. And they instilled in me, I think, a work ethic and a sense of teamwork that I think has defined a lot of what we've done around this company and what's kind of defined me, I think.
So talk to us about teamwork and how important it is in running a company. How does that really translate off the playing field?
In our company, probably at the top of the list. So we're in a services company. And again, sounds cliche. We have nothing to sell but our people. We don't have a product. We don't have a widget. It's really our people. We've got methodologies and tools, techniques that go behind that. But at the end of the day, we're selling our people. And as a small company, we're not going to get the opportunity based on our brand. I mean, our brand in our space is really big, but there are McKinsey's and Bain's and BCG's, and we have the same caliber of people that work at those companies, but we don't have the name on the front of the jersey, so to speak. So in order for us to be successful, we've got to collaborate. We've got to act as a team. We've got to basically put our client in front of our personal interest and in front of the company's interest many times. And that's kind of how we've just designed this company. We've been successful in recruiting because people that have that kind of orientation are the ones that we sort of promote and stay with us.
So it's one thing to start a company, especially if you have a backbone client that's coming over with you. But you've got a good sized company that you're running. And how did you learn to run a company? It's a whole lot different than giving advice.
So the running of the company, I was fortunate. The first partner with whom I worked at Deloitte was a juggernaut. He was classic type A personality and understood every dimension of the consulting business, of the services business. So all the economics, the operations, hiring, recruiting, sort of retention, everything was there. So I learned from that person, and I think, you know, that's kind of what I took to this company in terms of building this company. Beyond that, and probably more importantly, is we just hire people that are really, really good, and we get out of their way when we need to and let them do what they do best, which is serve our clients or run aspects of our business. So it's kind of, you know, picking the right team, I think, is probably as much of a ingredient to our success as anything that we as individuals can do.
I'm curious, the consulting business, particularly the business that you're in, has a reputation for sort of chewing people up and spitting them out. And yet you're talking about people as a valuable resource, as the key to the value in your company. How do you as a leader balance those things that, you know, people have lives, they have things that go wrong in their lives, they need to go take care of parents or children, but you also need them to be billing, you know, and doing their work. How do you wrestle with that issue as a leader?
It's a great question. So the first part of the answer is that you need to educate them on the way in. You need to be very clear about what they're getting into, particularly people that haven't come out of consulting. So once we are convinced that an individual has the right experience or caliber to do what we need them to do, we then go into almost an anti-sell mode. You know, have you thought about the travel? Have you thought about the hours? You know, these are investment banking hours or law firm hours. And we were very sort of clear about what this entails. Take the job anyway, despite our coaching or counseling to the sort of to the negative. And, you know, you have to sort of make adjustments. You know, we have somebody that has a family situation, be it a parent or a child, and they can't travel for a period of a couple of years. We try to find them in-town assignments. If you have somebody that needs to be home, you know, every day for 5 years, this is a tough business to be in. And, you know, those people oftentimes have to leave. You know, we didn't ask them to leave, but they would have to opt out. I mean, they can't do the work. There's nothing we can do about it. But a lot of it is really making sure they understand what they're getting into on the way in.
I'm curious, going back to the sports discussion about, you know, leadership and drive, what have you learned about leadership now running a company that you didn't learn on the sports field?
That's a great question. I think the biggest thing is that on the sports field, I think I was programmed to do everything we could to help our team win every game. There was no, you know, there wasn't like a consolation prize if you didn't win. I think in running a company, you learn that you can't possibly look at every single transaction or every event in which you're involved and basically try to optimize it. You have to look at the bigger picture. You have to kind of step back. And whether it's exactly what we're talking about, a staff person that can't travel for a period of a year because they have an ill mother or, you know, a family situation that otherwise warrants them not being able to travel, you can't force that. And you have to sort of be able to figure out how to compromise. So I think it's more than anything else, it's just kind of a realization that you can't possibly win if you're trying to optimize every single event.
Is that a bit of growing up too that's happening? To realize that you have to compromise on some things?
It's growing up. I think it's also at some point you sort of realize that we're going to be successful. You know, we can take our foot off the gas for periods of time or in certain dimensions, and we've got enough inertia now as a company that we're going to be successful without having to sort of press every billable hour or, you know, get every dot sort of or every I dotted and T crossed on a, you know, in a spreadsheet. So it's kind of a realization. It's growing up, and it's also getting comfortable in your own skin and realizing that there are things that are on balance going to allow you to be more successful as a company.
It also sounds like a more holistic view of success than transactional.
Yeah, so I think that's right. We still have this tendency to, you know, this restaurant mentality that you're as good as your last meal served, and if we serve a bad meal, we're not going to see that client again. We still consider it a privilege to serve our clients, who are principally Fortune 500 clients and principally the C-level suite of those clients. But at the same time, we also realize that, you know, we're in a people business, and we have to be able to throttle back when it's warranted.
What's the website?
www.paceharmon.com.
This is your host, Dana Theis, with my co-host, Mark Cohen of Optifor. Mark, would you like to thank our guests for us?
Sure. I'd like to thank all four of them. First is we listened to Pat Harrison, the president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Second, we heard from Nadi Samnong, the president and chairman and CEO of Omnifix, Inc. Third was Judd Allen, the co-founder and managing partner of Express Home Buyers. And with us right now at the microphone is Steve Martin, the co-founder and president of Pace Harmon.
And I would like to thank you, our listening audience, for listening. Because without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial